The Bookhouse is an independent bookstore with two locations in New Jersey, Millburn and Long Branch. Are you the guy who says they like to support indie bookstores? Good. Then be that guy. Come shop at The Bookhouse. Books, puzzles, games, coffee, cards, live author events, comedy nights, and most important, a real sense of community where actual human beings engage with one another. The Bookhouse in downtown Millburn and at Pier Village in Long Branch. That's The Bookhouse. Independent, local, quaint as fuck. Follow us on Instagram and come visit our stores.
Hi, I'm Liz Alterman, host of the Bookhouse podcast. Today, I'm talking with James Rhee, author of Red Helicopter, Lead Change with Kindness, Plus a Little Math, A Parable for Our Times. This best-selling book explores James's journey as the unlikely chairman, CEO, and some might say savior of Ashley Stewart, a plus-size women's clothing chain primarily employing and serving Black women, which is based in Secaucus, New Jersey. James is the son of Korean immigrants who modeled lives of service to others. Following in their example, after graduating from Harvard, James became a high school teacher. He went on then to graduate from Harvard Law with the intention of working as a public defender, but followed a different path and became a private equity investor before combining purpose with profitability in his role at Ashley Stewart. And all of this serves as inspiration for his wonderful book, Red Helicopter. James, welcome. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Hi, everyone. It's nice to be with you.
Thank you. So before we really dig in, I was hoping, James, you could share in your own words a little bit about where the title comes from and the Red Helicopter's significance.
Yeah, sure. I mean, we all live in trying times these days. It's important during periods of chaos to have a belief system for yourself, a narrative that sort of rings true for yourself intrinsically versus a lot of the noise that we hear in the world telling us to do things, telling us we should be better at something or we're bad at things. And so for me, metaphorically, that's what Red Helicopter means. And in my case, it was literally a red helicopter. It was an event that happened when I was five and I had come home from kindergarten with a toy red helicopter. And then there was like a cacophony of accusations and opportunities for me to think I was wrong, but I held my ground. So my parents at first thought I took it from school, which was a public school in Long Island. And you have to picture me with a bowl cut, big dimple. Right. And I sort of stood my ground and said, no, I didn't steal it. I got it as a gift. And then they thought they had done something wrong, that maybe that American customs dictated that every five-year-old gave gifts at Christmas. And I said, I was the only one who got it. Right. And then they got annoyed with me because I didn't know why that this family had given me this toy. And my father sort of interrogated me a bit and he had found out why. The reason is that I'd been sharing half my lunch that my mom made every morning with my friend who often didn't have lunch. And the dad and his siblings had come in to say thank you in a really generous and very subtle way. And I didn't know that my friend's mom had died that summer. Wow. And my dad was trying to explain this to me, that that's why they gave it to you. And, you know, five-year-old boy with a lot of wisdom and courage, right? Because right. The answer was that he didn't have food and he was my friend. I gave him half my lunch and I had enough. And that sort of abundance mindset is something that's harder to hold on to as you get older. And we mistake education and credentials and achievements for wisdom. So that's what Red Helicopter means. And I'm asking people in the world today, like, what do you think of that story? Is that wise?
Right. No, I love that. And I love also on your website, under your Immerse tab, I saw where you have partnered with All American High School Film Festival to encourage high school students to share their Red Helicopter stories. And I think, you know, sometimes what resonated for me when I listened to your audiobook was when you talk about your family interrogating you and sort of the tables were turned on you rather quickly, you know, when you're five. And it just made me think of my grandmother would always say, no good deed goes unpunished. And so, you know, here you are doing this generous thing and yet you're the subject of interrogation. But I think sometimes people don't even realize, like you, before you received the helicopter, you had no idea what that what you were doing meant so much to that boy, and that it is hard to retain that spirit in today's world. And so with that, I just want to say I had listened to the audiobook which you narrate, and I think whenever the author narrates their own book, it brings just so much heart to the prose. And what struck me was the way you really straddle that line between business book and, you know, imparting this leadership wisdom and also memoir. And I loved when you described the book early on as a celebration of humanity. And so in addition to the kindness, which is a recurring theme throughout, we also learn about the importance of music in your life. And right from the start, rather than referring to the opening pages as a prologue, you chose the word prelude. And you note that you're going to tell this story in a three-act structure with a bridge between acts two and three, which certainly will appeal to musical theater fans. So I would love to hear more about how you chose that structure and the role of music in your life.
Sure. I mean, music, I am a high in musicality, want to be professional musician, but I do think in terms of music, and music is the language of humanity. And
absolutely,
from a neuroscience perspective, just to dig in there, music defies all binary systems. It requires your entire brain, and in MIT speak, we would say it's like the ultimate example of a systems dynamic, right? It is not a linear processing of understanding music. That's not how our brains work. Even so, in real life, we try to make things very linear and binary, but our own brains, and music reminds us of this, is that it's quite the opposite of what humanity is. And that's why music is so important to what it means to be human. And so as an investor and as a human, even though this may sound a bit odd to people, I listen to people as instruments. I can hear people. I memorize people's art, my dialogue with them in terms of songs, you know, how you can retain knowledge of a song from when you were in junior high school.
Sure.
That's how I remember people. And I can hear them well. I can hear when they are trying to put on a voice that it's not, they don't feel comfortable or safe, or, and I won't say this literally, but I'll tell them, you're an oboe. How come you're pretending to be a flute right now?
How interesting. And how did they respond to that, James?
Yeah, I don't say that literally to them, but the way the book is written and the way I am and the way I lead, I create environments that are, people don't have to do that.
Sure, they can be their authentic selves.
Yeah, and they intuitively can gauge that. A lot of people, when they read the book, they say, geez, it's just like you're giving us permission to be the people we want to be. And I just said, well, isn't that what leadership is? So I wrote the book, and when I invest in brands or anything, I hear the music first. So the book, the musical structure of the entire book was done first. I actually drew out the book, sort of had the song of the book written out, not perfectly composed, but composed. And then I filled in the book with lyrics, which in a book we would call words.
Sure.
And I had a tone of the book and a key of the book. I wrote in the acknowledgments, the book was written in E flat major, which is sort of, it's a 3-flat major key. It's a key you would hear with like your song, Elton John, or when Tony sings to Maria and Maria sings to Tony in West Side Story, when they sing Somewhere.
Okay, sure.
That key evokes imagination and hope in real music. So I tried to write the book in E flat major. And it's written literally as a piece of music. I mean, there are 3 acts. It's written sort of as a hybrid between a serenade and an anthem.
Wow. And that's another point I'd love to touch on, is that you really, it seems, stay very true to your instincts. And when I was listening to your acknowledgments, which I always feel the acknowledgments are one of my absolute favorite parts of a book, you really thank your editors for their faith in you, for sort of letting you experiment and having that faith in you. And I think a lot of authors are not as fortunate to have, you know, such a team behind them. And I loved also when you shared that going from, you know, living such kind of a dynamic life where you're in the public eye and then sitting down to write, which is often such a solitary endeavor, that you, there were times when you struggled a little bit in writing this book. Could you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, it's lonely writing.
It is. Yes.
And it's, you know, it also forces you to confront yourself, your demons. You have to be very honest or else, you know, people know. And so it's isolating and it's exacting at the same time. And so, yeah, I got very fortunate. I'm a first time author.
And a bestseller, which is.
And credit to Harper One. I mean, when I was sort of putting this out for those who are listening, who are writers or seasoned writers or someone who's looking to get their first sort of published deal, you know, it was the whole bidding process and the proposal process was very new to me. And I realized that people really, their boxes sometimes in publishing, right? They said, what type of book is it? And I would answer, well, it is none of what you think it is. It's a memoir, it's philosophy, it's a piece of music, it's business, it's all of it.
And, it really is.
You know, and I think a lot of people are like that. Most, all of us are like that in life, you know.
Like, right, multidimensional.
We all are. And like, we're living in a society that increasingly doesn't want that.
Yes, everyone's told to stay in their lane and brand yourself and just pick one thing and get, you know, become an expert in that. But so much more interesting when you...
Yeah, and we suppress our most interesting things because sometimes we're led to believe that it's embarrassing or wrong. And that's not how I live my life and my, it's not how I approach my relationships with people. It's one of the anthems I'm singing in this book saying, like, if no one else likes your idiosyncrasies or whatever, then call me. Like, I'll like it, you know, and you can just be who you want to be. And so on the book process, you can imagine people were like, huh, first time author. You know, I don't really love social media. Like,
oh, sure.
For all the reasons we shouldn't like it.
Right.
And so they were like, well, and then, you know, we don't love that. We want you to write a business book. And I said, no, I don't want to.
Good for you. Good for you. Yes. I mean, there's plenty of those out there. And this has so much heart and the way you bring in your parents, which I think that is often missing in so many books. We meet this person, but we don't know their background and we don't know their influences and what made them the person they are today. And I think that, you know, it's a beautiful tribute to your parents. And it also really shines a light on how you became the person you are today. So I think it would be missing. It would be such a disservice to you and all you have to share to have eliminated that from the book.
Yeah, because the whole book is structured. The reason why it's structured not just in three parts with a bridge, but it's structured in order of consequence. Like, life is the bigger envelope and then money is the second act and then joy. Mm-hmm. And so what I'm trying to, in my roundabout way, is to convey to readers that your life obviously transcends work and that you like to live a life of joy and self-fulfillment, and the money part gets in the way. And like, here's some money tips for you to how to sort of to accomplish a joyful life. That's why it's structured that way. And yeah, my parents were, I mean, we tried to divorce work and all of these things from our personal upbringings and lives. But like, for me, it's very clear to me the type of life that I want to live, the type of legacy that I want to have. I'm fighting for a world that I want for my children, particularly my daughters.
Right.
You know, one of the things in your intro that I'll sort of just like quibble with just a little bit, it was a beautiful intro, but I would not call myself the savior of Ashley Stewart. I think the reason why it all happened and the why it worked was that I was not the savior. And I think the women that really embraced me, even though I was underqualified, didn't look the part, I think that they, what they gave to me, invested in me, far outweighed what I was able to accomplish for them. And
right. I guess I was seeing you through their eyes, and I think they absolutely would. They would probably side with me, James, I have to say.
Yeah. Well, maybe, you know,
Right. But it definitely, it came through as a clear team effort. And I think that's something that's so important in life is that, you know, you say to someone, I believe in you, and they're going to mirror that back to you. And together, what you can accomplish is so much greater when you're working together. And I think that's what we see here. So,
yeah, well, I call that just having really good, real friendships, you know,
right.
I think that we lose sight of that as adults. It's very hard. I hearken back a lot to childhood and just like wisdom. But childhood friends, they like you because you are kind to them and make them laugh.
Exactly. And especially in the workplace, we lose that, unfortunately, no matter how many bagel breakfasts and cupcake birthday parties they throw your way, right?
That's right. And, you know, all of these lessons, the book is really, like, for me, I'm sort of I didn't really want to write the book in first person narrative, but because it was a first book for me, it was introducing myself. So it's a very soft I think that the most of the narrative, and I know the protagonists, they're all the very strong women in my life. It's my mom, it's the women of Ashley Stewart, and it's my wife.
Absolutely. And I think too, Ashley herself becomes a character, which I really loved that, you know, it really makes the reader care about, you wouldn't think, you know, if somebody were writing about another company, we might not care as much, but the way she sort of becomes the symbol of all of these women in your life who deserve, you know, all good things. It's just really, it's so inspiring. But I just want to go back one moment. I know on your website, and when we talk about music, you refer to yourself as a frustrated musician. But I would argue that you, as someone myself who plays nothing other than, you know, podcasts and the radio, you're an accomplished musician. I was hoping that you could share a little bit about Ari Wrong and Amazing Grace, which our listeners can go and find on your website, which is redhelicopter.com under the Immerse tab. And that was arranged by Chad Cannon. And from what I understand, you work together to really bring this piece to sort of convey the narrative of the book through music. I was hoping you could share a little bit about that endeavor and where you've gone with that.
Sure. I mean, it's Ariyang is like it really means to be Korean. It's like the even more important equivalent of like God Bless America.
Okay. Right?
It's if you are Korean, you live this song. And then Amazing Grace is obviously a global song as well. And it's very important, particularly to the Black community. Mm-hmm. And both songs are folk songs. No one knows the author, and some of the best, this book is a celebration of those truths that no one claims ownership to. They just emerge. And so symbolically, it's the piece on the website, it ultimately climaxes at a point where the two pieces are in perfect counterpoint, which means it's a metaphor and it's a technical music point where they are both singing equally as the lead, as the melody, and that the third melody that emerges is even more beautiful. I think oftentimes in life and in relationships, we think musically that there's always a lead, a melody, and then there's a harmony. Which, if you think about it, makes the harmony not as important. I've tried to live my life, and I think real leadership is this, is that you allow people to sing their song, to be the melody, but that they have to sing it in a way where the emergent melody is more beautiful. And that's why the book, the music is structured that way, the book is structured that way. And, you know, it's... The music is composed in that same key I mentioned. So it's both joyful and sad. It evokes both emotions, which is the reality of life. I think sometimes in the US, we are sort of told to be happy all the time and to be toxically optimistic. And it's just, it doesn't serve anyone well because life is full of loss.
That's so true. Yes, there's almost a mournful quality to it. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe it plays sort of as the backdrop for your acknowledgments in the story and the audiobook. Is that correct?
Yeah. So we divide it up into three acts accordingly. And at the very end, it's like the end of a musical on Broadway. We play the entire piece and just picture all of the characters taking their bow.
Right.
At the very end. And if you're asking me, is this book going to get adapted into a movie and a musical? Yeah, of course it is. So it's a global audience. The book is getting translated into a bunch of languages. I just got back from Korea. Spanish and Portuguese are coming out this year. And
oh, congratulations.
Yeah. Like I hope that it's the book is written as a parable, and because I want everyone to sort of celebrate the universality of our collective humanity. And I think it's in a time when we need it. And the other art, the other song that's sort of like rifling through this book, and this is a New Jersey bookstore and book audience, is that I'm a huge Springsteen fan, right?
Yes.
So this book and is really an anthem. It's really like Born to Run. I'm asking, and I used to say this to the women at Ashley, and I know you read the book, Liz, like the whole world turned its back on me.
Right. Yes, your investors, your friends, right? You're really out on a limb there.
So just picture me in Bruce style showing up on a motorcycle and singing to a group of women and saying, you know, will you walk with me out on a wire?
Right.
Maybe I'm just a scared and lonely rider, but I got to know how it feels. I want to know if love is wild, girl. I want to know, is love real? And I effectively sang that song to this group of women, and they said, you know what? We'll ride.
Mm-hmm. And, ride or die, right?
So that was. And we did. And so you can read it with a Bruce Springsteen lens as well. Like, it's an anthem.
Right. And that's one thing I wanted to touch on also, James, for our listeners and music fans. You put together a playlist of the songs that you feel captured the emotions associated with each chapter. And that really spans the gamut from the Beatles and Barbara Streisand to Beyonce and Bruce Springsteen, as you say. And I also love when toward the end of the book, when you talk about Moon River and your parents. And so your taste really spans such a broad range. And I love that. But I was wondering, as a writer myself, do you listen to music as you write?
I listen to music all of the time.
Okay.
And I play music. I generally have a guitar within 5 feet from my keyboard. And I've got sort of a violin, like, you know, 100 feet away, and a piano on the third floor. So I sort of just, I sort of think while playing and listening to music. But when I'm actually writing,
mm-hmm.
I turn it off.
Okay.
Yeah. But then while I'm writing, I will not listen to music, but I will play and strum music when I'm stuck.
I have heard that from many different authors, that they sort of step away, strum their guitar, and these plot knots sort of untangle as they're playing, which makes me almost want to take some lessons.
You should. I mean, that's the other gist of the book. It's just like,
right?
Like just taking a chance and learning and being a kid and like just with, you know, stopping the striving for perfection. It's, you know, it's just asking, it's beginner's mindset, right? It's just asking for help and learning new things.
Exactly. And so since writing was new to you, James, I was hoping you could share a little bit about your own literary inspirations, who you enjoy reading or who you grew up reading, anything you could share with us.
Sure. I read a lot of these days nonfiction. So as an adult, you may think it's boring, but I read a lot of nonfiction on, you know, it's philosophy, it's latest in neuro and cog sci. I don't read a lot of these boring business books where they say, here are the 5 things you're terrible at, do these. I don't read those books.
Right.
But a lot of the things about human behavior are the latest in that I read. And then, you know, growing up, I really liked, and I studied this in school, but I really liked Austin, Dickens.
Sure.
Melville. It was a period of time when novelists were also doubling as economists.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So they were really commenting on the condition of humanity. All three of those authors were particularly facile at doing that. Right.
Absolutely.
So that's what I would read. And so that's one of the reasons why I structured and wrote the book this way. It is a book that's commenting on the human condition, economics and money included, but it's in the prism of the humanities.
Absolutely. Yes. And I love that too, that you, not only were you working to help your colleagues, you know, sort of bring this company back, you know, from the brink, but also you were helping them personally with a lot of those financial literacy, just topics that, that unfortunately are not taught in schools. And I think we're still fighting to get a lot of those things in there. And I was hoping you could share a little bit about, I know you have also taught at MIT as well as Howard. And I was hoping you could share a little bit about what you do and how you bring those topics to people to sort of help them change their own circumstances or turn them around for the better and make wiser decisions.
Yeah, well, the whole book is really a comment on agency. Right. Mm-hmm. It's about what does it mean? What does it mean to make decisions, informed decisions for yourself? What are the limits of agency? What's not in your control? What element of humble surrender is encompassed by agency? And so, yeah, at Howard, I'm still chair of entrepreneurship there. And my class is called The Systems of Life, Money, and Joy. Mm-hmm. And at MIT, I teach something similar. At Duke Law School, I teach something similar. And I'm a public school kid. I just think that we have failed so many people in this country, like 99.99% of people, because we're not giving them the right framework, which the book tries to, about why you're actually learning. Mm-hmm. You're learning because you're hoping to have better sense of your own agency. And so my classes, you know, it's what's in the book. There's Cogsci. Neurosci, like how does your brain work? Most mm-hmm. people don't know how the first system is their brain, right. is our brain. Most people don't know how their brain works, which leaves them very vulnerable to charlatans and tech companies who are very willing to feed you algorithms that strip away your agency, which is what's happening.
Yes.
And then I teach, it's a lot of philosophy and ethics, which were sort of neuroscience before there was such thing as neuroscience. And in a lot of ways, this book is sort of an odd secular faith book, mm-hmm. right? It's and then I teach about money, and money's part of having agency. And a lot of people, most people are not taught about anything about money, about how money's structured, the convention of it, how do you make it, how do you account for it? And then I also went to law school, as you said before. And so most people don't know how the laws are set up. But that's where we are as a, you know, humanity now. The reason why I wrote this book when I did, I wanted it to be released for this year in 2024. Mm-hmm. And I'm asking people and saying, what does it mean to have agency? What does it mean to be human in the future?
Right. Absolutely. With everything that's coming at us from every direction. Well, James, thank you. I just have to ask on a personal level, to me, you are in so many places and doing all these things. How do you get your energy? What really fills up your well, if you could share with listeners? Because I was just so impressed when I was thinking as I was listening, does James sleep? When does he find the time to sleep?
Well, you know, it's in chapter 5. Remember that thing I talk about, the T account, about getting rid yes. of things that you think are assets that are not? Mm-hmm. I have a very clean, quote, balance sheet. Like, I don't waste a lot of time or energy about things that I used to care about. Like, there was a lot of ego death in this book. Okay. And a lot of me died in that cafeteria, right? Like, it's right. So that's one thing. It's really sort of controlling my own ego and neuroses and insecurities. And I just, After the readers read through the book, you'll understand that a lot of it is just gone. So that's number one. And then number two is I care very deeply about people. I'm a former high school teacher, and I'm still a teacher at heart. I get a lot of joy seeing other people like fulfill their potential. Like, it sounds trite, but it just is how I am.
No, it is. It's very energizing if you can steer someone to reach their fullest potential and see what that does for them. It sort of gives you that boost. So
yeah, you get it right back. Right.
Exactly.
And then the last thing is getting back to system structure and like music, the things I do, it's in system dynamics talk, we would call reinforcing loops. Mm-hmm. So if I do something in my life, it tries to create joy and be also financially smart. So like everything I do, I try to, it creates loops in so many other loops. So if I'm teaching, it helps me learn. It helps me communicate. It helps me write. It it furthers the cause of Red Helicopter. If I invest money as a my private equity life, I don't do things that are hypocritical or run counter to all the things I do with Red Helicopter philosophy and what I teach in the classroom. Like everything I do, it's looped.
Sure.
And so when you do
and
that,
reinforcing.
Yes, reinforcing loops. So that that it creates leverage in terms of time. Instead of having 24 hours, you have 240 hours in a day.
Right.
And then combine that with not wasting time, like not not scrolling, doom scrolling, and not sort of like, you know, kvetching about like silly things that because, you know, of your ego, then you also save a lot of time from that.
Absolutely. That's great advice for all of us to take in. Well, James, thank you so much for your time today. It's been such a pleasure. And I was hoping you could share with readers where they can find you. I know your website is redhelicopter.com. I don't know if you have any speaking engagements coming up or anything online where our readers can check you out. I know your TED Talk is phenomenally viewed and has gone viral. If you could point us toward the best places to find you, that would be great.
Yeah, I think on redhelicopter.com, there's a schedule of events coming up. There's ways to sign up for sort of the content that's coming. You can find me on LinkedIn. I have a very weak and sort of begrudging presence on Instagram, which is I am James Ree. And, you know, I think that the TED Talk's a great start. The book, I hope you really enjoy it. Listen to the music. And people seem to really also like my conversation with Brené Brown. That has probably gone more viral than the TED Talk.
Oh, that's wonderful. Yes, that I listened to that as well. And she's always, always inspired. I feel like when you, after you listen to her, you come away almost the same way if you've taken a yoga class or a good run. You just feel kind of refreshed. So that's wonderful. Well, James, thank you again. It's been a pleasure. And I wish you all the best with everything coming up for you and Red Helicopter.
Thank you. It was fun.
Thanks.
Original production. The Bookhouse is an independent bookstore with two locations in New Jersey, Millburn and Long Branch. Are you the guy who says they like to support indie bookstores? Good. Then be that guy. Come shop at The Bookhouse. Books, puzzles, games, coffee, cards, live author events, comedy nights, and most important, a real sense of community where actual human beings engage with one another. The Bookhouse in downtown Millburn and at Pier Village in Long Branch. That's The Bookhouse. Independent, local, quaint as fuck. Follow us on Instagram and come visit our stores.